This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And today we're talking about bloggers, not just any bloggers, mommy bloggers. Thousands and thousands of them are out there, moms who write intimate accounts of their lives with their children. They have become a marketing goldmine. Companies love to advertise on these blogs, and that's causing a mommy war online. We sent NPR's David Shaper to the annual Blog Her conference in Chicago over the weekend. He learned all about this growing rift over Blogola, free goodies, products, trips, and other perks that marketers are giving to bloggers, mommy bloggers, in hopes of getting favorable publicity.
More than 1,500 people attended this, the fifth annual and biggest Blog Her conference yet. And yet it's a mere fraction of the tens of thousands of women bloggers out there. Many are like Kristen Chase, the Atlanta-based author of Motherhood Uncensored, who started blogging 4 years ago to connect with other moms.
I was a Yankee transplant living in Mississippi. I just married a military guy, and I felt completely out of my comfort zone, to say the least. And I was pregnant by surprise, and I just didn't know anyone.
Liz Gumbiner of New York started her blog, Mom 101, for a similar reason.
When I found myself with a baby after 35 years of not having had a baby, I had a slow learning curve, and I was looking to connect.
Both found other moms with whom they poured out their hearts and souls in their blogs, and up sprung an increasingly powerful online community. With moms controlling upwards of 80% of household spending, it was only a matter of time before mommy bloggers and now Twitterers were reviewing and promoting products and services. Companies from Walmart and Kmart to Ragu and Michelin tires work with mom bloggers. And in some cases, Gumbiner says, lines are being blurred.
Bloggers used to have sponsors sponsor their writing. Now they're actually writing for sponsors. And I think that's actually changed the dynamic of the blogosphere a great deal.
Advertising on blogs used to be separated from editorial content, but more and more, Gumbiner says, they're mixed together.
To some degree, it's gone from a very authentic community to one where, unfortunately, people are often questioning the integrity of the motives on the blog.
Some say the problem lies with the PR and marketing firms that inundate the mommy bloggers with free product offers and trips in exchange for reviews. Tricia Haas of the site MomDot says that promotional swag almost guarantees positive reviews.
We're receiving a product for free. We're excited it came in the mail. We're going to possibly get traffic off of it. So by being positive, that's the feeling we're getting. Is it authentic? I'm not sure.
Haas and the other bloggers of MomDot are calling for a PR blackout the week of August 10th. But some in the blogosphere say what's really needed is for bloggers to be more upfront in disclosing whether they're paid or getting free products. The site Blog with Integrity is asking bloggers to sign and post an ethical pledge. Meanwhile, the Federal Trade Commission is considering new guidelines to help clarify what constitutes advertising in the blogosphere. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
For more on the mommy blogger movement, I'm joined by our technology expert, Omar Gayaga. He writes about digital culture for the Austin American Statesman. Hi, Omar.
Hi, good to be here.
So I guess the FTC might investigate mommy bloggers?
Yeah, and the issue seems to be disclosure. If you go to a site and you find on a Google search, for instance, is that site legitimately reviewing products or are they being paid for it? Or are they getting free products in exchange for positive reviews? I did a story on mommy bloggers recently, and a lot of the bloggers I talk to definitely openly admit that they only post positive reviews. They tend not to focus on the negative, and they are getting free products.
Okay, but these mommy blogs, they started off a little bit differently, right? These were basically confessional, almost diary type blogs where moms were just trying to connect with other moms online and find some kind of community and express what was going on.
Right. But what's happened is over the last couple of years, I think Nielsen Online tracks something like 12,000 mom blogs. They recently came out with a list of the Power Mom 50, the top mommy bloggers in the country. So there is this kind of shift from the very personal to mom blogs shifting toward product reviews and things that attract more viewers, and also looking at different niches where they can specialize in a specific kind of blogging, like, say, crafting or stepmom blogs or focusing on gay and lesbian issues.
And so do you still have those original blogs out there that aren't about products and aren't about marketing niches?
You do. In fact, I mean, the most famous mom blogger out there is Heather Armstrong, who writes at Deuce.com, and she still posts pictures of her kids and writes about her personal life. Of course, she's juggling it now with TV appearances and book signings, but she definitely definitely still writes a lot about her personal life and her feelings and is a very sharp writer, which I think is what attracted people to her in the first place.
But bloggers are also using all sorts of new technology to get people to their sites.
Right. I mean, one of the most fascinating things I saw was just these enormous networks of mom bloggers. The Mom Bloggers Club, which is based out of North Carolina, attracted 5,000 bloggers within 2 years of starting, which is just amazing. So social networking definitely plays a part. A lot of these blogs are using Twitter and Facebook to try to build an audience that way through social networking. And of course, there's videos and podcasts. I mean, I looked at your website, Parenting on the Edge, and it's more of a reported podcast than a traditional mom blog. You know, if you're able to tell people stories on video or through audio podcasts and kind of distribute it out and let people know about it through the social network. So they're definitely tying together not just with the written word, but also through all these ways of networking and getting the word out and connecting with other mom bloggers.
Yeah. And so what about dads? Are they doing their own thing? Because I think, you know, a lot of people want to bring dads into the conversation.
Yeah, there are definitely quite a lot of dad bloggers out there. There just hasn't really been one that's emerged the way Heather Armstrong has for mom bloggers. There's not really a dad blog celebrity yet. There is one company out of Austin called Dad Labs that does a video blog.
One of the most difficult things to do when you're giving your kids a bath is to rinse the shampoo out of their hair. Well, today I'm reviewing the Sassy Bath Visor, and they come in cute colors. You got this red one, you got this green one, they got a bunch of other colors as well.
So, Omar, it sounds like they're trying to get in on the product endorsement train there, but is this website, does it have more than just product reviews?
Yeah, it's mostly all videos, but they also do a lot of educational stuff, you know, what to do if your kid has an accident in the bathtub, a guy trying out a breast pump to kind of see what that experience is like. Very humorous, but also very educational. The guys who founded it were former teachers, and I've actually appeared in a couple of their videos. They're here in town. They recently got comedian Kevin Nealon to do a video they're going to be posting in August. So maybe that'll raise the profile and maybe dad blogs will be the next big thing.
And Omar, maybe you can quit your day job. Okay. Omar.
Where's the cash?
Omar Gayaga covers digital culture for the Austin American Statesman. Thanks, Omar.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. And we will definitely be posting links to a lot of these blogs and to the story I did on mommy bloggers on the All Tech blog at npr.org/alltech, newly redesigned.
And not just the blog that's redesigned, the whole website is redesigned. It was unveiled today. Go check it out, npr.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Genealogy is a hugely popular pastime for millions of Americans. For some, it's an adventure that can take them back centuries and to distant lands. For others, it can be a frustrating path down blind alleys leading to dead ends. African Americans often make the most difficult journey. There's the emotional toll of reconstructing lives spent in bondage, and the sheer frustration of finding documentation. Most slaves didn't have birth or death certificates, and many records, like bills of sale, had only first names and approximate ages. Now, a group in St. Croix is working to make that research a little easier. The Virgin Islands Social History Associates has compiled a comprehensive set of records from the Caribbean slave trade and is working with Ancestry.com to put those records into a searchable online database. George Tyson is president of the Virgin Islands Social History Associates, and he joins us from Frederickstead, St. Croix. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Leanne.
What kind of documents have you been compiling? What kind of records? What information do these documents contain?
Well, the records that we've been using are very diverse. We have, of course, census records. They start in 1835 during the period of slavery. We have an enormous amount of church records that start in the 18th century in the case of the Moravian Church that came here to proselytize among the enslaved population. We have so-called Negro slave tax lists because the Danes required the slave owner, starting in the early 1770s, to compile lists of the slaves that they had. We have plantation inventories, records of sales from the slave ships to the plantations, which enable us to track people who are coming off particular ships onto particular properties on St. Croix. And collectively, it enables the researcher to develop detailed life stories about many, many of the people who lived on St. Croix during the period of slavery, and to follow them and their families into the post-emancipation period.
You found the story of a woman. Her name was Venus. Would it be Johannes?
Johannes, that's correct.
You traced her story. What is it?
I was going through the police records, and I came upon this story of Venus Johannes. She was being enslaved illegally here on St. Croix, and the authorities interviewed her, and the interview has survived, and she tells the story of her capture in what is today Senegal along the Salom River, her being taken to Gore, where she was enslaved to the Pepin family. And in 1800, an American ship captain came from St. Croix on a slave trading voyage, became attracted to her, and eventually arranged to marry her. And then the ship captain, a man by the name of Maddock, had to return to St. Croix. And when Maddock and Venus arrived here in Frederickstead in 1800, he sold her into slavery. And she remained a slave until 1815, when the authorities investigated the case. And as a consequence of that, she became free. She had already had four children by then. After she became free, she had three other children with a man by the name of John Johannes, hence she took the name Venus Johannes. And we were able to use the database material to track the family up to 1917 and then connect them to people who are alive today on St. Croix and in the United States.
Now that the Virgin Islands Social History Associates have compiled this gold mine of information, and the records are going to be available online, what should someone with no experience in genealogical research begin?
I think you really need to begin with the census records, and that's what we have online right now. Then once they have found somebody, you will get information, of course, about their general age and their religious affiliation. And if you are lucky, they will have information about their families, because the families would be in the same household and they would identify family relationships. It is possible then to track people backwards to the period of slavery. And then you can use the records that have to do with the slave list, the plantation inventories, and use those records to track your ancestors back into the 18th century.
Would you begin with a contemporary ancestor and work your way backwards?
Yes, you must. We only go to 1917. So anybody wanting to use this database is going to have to find an ancestor who was alive in 1917. And the best way to do that, of course, is to do family interviews. Talk to your parents or your grandparents or great-grandparents, if you can, and see if they can give you the names of their ancestors so that you can get somebody back to 1911. Of course, it is not that easy. There's a lot of cross-referencing. It's very difficult to use these records in some ways because names are not spelled in a regular manner. One has to be very cautious about and creative in terms of how one uses the names that we have here. And the other problem is that these records are old, and as a consequence, they were not always easy to transcribe and compile into the database. So there will be challenges for people to do this. But I can tell you, having used the database myself, it can go very fast.
George Tyson is president of the Virgin Islands Social History Associates. Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very much.
When Iranians used Twitter to get out news about their recent election, people took note in China. Compared to Iran, Twitter played a much smaller role in the recent ethnic clashes in Western China. But many Chinese do believe Twitter and its Chinese imitators have considerable potential to change their media and their society, as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing.
Several Chinese NGOs recently held a training course here to teach citizen journalists how to use Twitter and other new media in their reporting. The main speaker was one of China's better-known Twitterati, Zhou Shuguang, whose pen name is Zola. Zola says that when he's reporting on politically sensitive stories, Twitter is not only a good reporting tool, it can also protect him in case he gets detained.
Citizen journalists will usually say at what time and what place they made their last move. If they run into trouble, netizens or journalists can track them based on the final clues they leave.
Also speaking at the event was Ma Xiaolin, a former foreign correspondent with the official Xinhua News Agency. He now runs Bolianshe, an alliance of Chinese bloggers. He says social media can be very empowering, but their importance has been exaggerated by traditional media's failures. The reason this kind of citizen behavior has exploded, he says, is because our traditional media are out of place. They're not fulfilling their proper role and professional responsibilities. If they don't do it right, others will do it for them. In the past couple of years, social media have played a significant role in breaking news on sensitive topics, including official corruption and civil unrest. Traditional media are feeling the heat. China Central Television, for example, is planning the biggest revamp of its flagship evening news program in years. But when bloody clashes between ethnic minority Uyghurs and majority Han erupted in far west Xinjiang province on July 5th, Twitter's impact was limited. Ismail An is a young Twitterer in East China. He's also a member of China's Muslim Hui minority. He says Uyghurs were either not online or chose to remain silent.
It was as if Xinjiang remained under a veil. After the internet was cut, locals had an even harder time making their voices heard. Besides, those who understood the use of social media were not necessarily sympathetic to the Uyghurs.
The official Xinhua news agency reported on the violence within hours. By the following morning, the government had cut all internet service in Xinjiang province, with the notable exception of a press center for foreign and domestic journalists. Police later questioned Ismail about his writings expressing sympathy with disaffected Uyghurs.
They said my blog postings were inciting racial hatred. I think this was a false accusation. They were making a taboo of the ethnic minority issue and forbidding me to discuss my ethnicity and my Muslim brothers and sisters.
In recent months, China has blocked social media sites including YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Similar sites inside China have been forced to shut themselves down temporarily or face penalties. As of Wednesday, one Chinese microblogging site called GY was still running. Its CEO, Li Zhuohuan, explains that his website is popular because it uses a Chinese language interface and users can post entries via cell phone text messages and instant messaging platforms.
Everyone knows that the Chinese people's quantity and frequency of cell phone text messaging is very high. China also has a very large number of people using the QQ instant messaging software. Users like to share information with their friends in real time.
Li notes that as on Twitter, posts to GY are limited to 140 characters. But Li points out that 140 Chinese characters contain double or even triple the expressive power of the same thing in English. Li adds that for now, most of his users are content to entertain themselves. But he says he hopes his website will be of more social significance in future.
These are things that are harder to do, but of course I hope that in the future our government will give this kind of media their recognition or even begin supporting and using it.
China's leaders like to surf the web, but they're not tweeting yet. Yesterday, GY posted a notice that it too was temporarily closed for maintenance. Media watchers believe GY and other Chinese sites may reopen after the sensitive 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China on October 1st. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
NPR's business news starts with a new alliance in the search engine wars. Microsoft and Yahoo have announced they are joining forces. It's not a takeover. Microsoft tried to buy Yahoo last year and failed. This is an alliance of online search and search advertising. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
In simple terms, Microsoft will provide the technology to run Yahoo Search, and Yahoo will become the sales force for all search-related ads. The 10-year deal caps a long and sometimes stormy relationship between the two companies. Both have struggled to compete against Google, which has more than 65% of the search market and the ad revenue that goes with it. By combining forces, Microsoft and Yahoo will be better able to compete against the market leader. In a conference call early this morning, Carol Bartz, Yahoo CEO, put it this way.
This deal will create a significant competitive alternative in search. Everyone wants a real alternative, and advertisers are no different.
In exchange for giving Microsoft the keys to its search engine, Yahoo will get to keep nearly all the revenue from search and ad sales on its sites for the first 5 years. But there is no big upfront payment for Yahoo. Danny Sullivan is the editor of Search Engine Land.
For Yahoo, it kind of gets Microsoft off their back and gives them some breathing room. For Microsoft, it instantly propels them to being the number two search player.
But the deal must still be approved by antitrust regulators. Again, Danny Sullivan.
One argument is that by having a stronger competitor to Google, that consumers will benefit because, you know, there'll be more competition. But the other argument is there was better competition when you had three independent search players rather than just two.
Microsoft and Yahoo hope to get the regulatory okay sometime next year, and then the deal designed to take on Google can be completed. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Remember those high-tech, full-body suits that were worn by all those record-setting Olympic swimmers? Well, the international organization that sets the rules for the Olympics and international competition voted today to ban those suits. FINA, that swimming's governing body, set maximum coverage for swimsuits. They're different for men and women, but the specs ban those suits. And FINA set rules about what kind of textiles or fabric a suit can be made of. Joining me now is Jim Wood, who is the president of USA Swimming. That's the U.S. governing association for the sport. And first, let's establish this is a change that USA Swimming supported and proposed.
Yeah, that is correct. It's the legislation that we proposed back last November.
Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. I think that the first and foremost is the new technology in suits probably were more performance-enhancing than just allowing an athlete to compete at their ability level. They actually changed the complexion of strokes. They allowed athletes who were not very strong in the core to not need to be because they had core stabilization. They allowed athletes who were not great technically to float higher in the water because they were buoyant. And they were extremely expensive, which created a real difficult situation for a large number of athletes that can't afford to spend $600 for a bathing suit several times a year. But the primary reason is that they made the sport unfair.
Unfair. Now, we should note, as unfair as it may have been, that unfairness seemed to benefit U.S. swimmers at the Olympics.
Well, I don't think so. I think maybe some of our swimmers went faster, but I believe that our swimmers definitely had the appropriate spots on the podium based on past performances and where they were. I think it benefited other athletes maybe to a greater extent. We have found that from watching these suits over the past year and a half, they became prevalent really at the Short Course World Championships in Manchester in March of 2008. And having watched them, it seems that the athletes slightly below the elite level of a Natalie Coughlin and a Michael Phelps probably had greater benefits from the suits than those athletes did.
However, many, many records were broken at the Olympic Games in Beijing, and there was much discussion of this. Do you think that with the new rules banning those full-body suits, we're going to see times, perhaps the order of finish may be the same, but do we think that the times are going to get worse?
Oh, I think for the time being, the times might get slower, but athletes are pretty resilient that way, and when they set their sights on breaking world records, they definitely step up the level of training that they do, and I think a number of these records will be broken in the next couple of years.
But over 100 world records were broken last year. And how much of that would you attribute to the suits?
I would say at least 60-70% of it.
Most of it, in other words.
I would say yes.
Okay, tell us what the limits, roughly, what will this suit look like? How will it be different from what we've seen in recent international competitions?
Well, the restrictions are that male suit will be from the hips down to the knees, so that means there'll be no upper body coverage at all on the male suits. The female suits will be from knees up to the shoulders and not up to the neck. The arms will be exposed, the shoulders will just have a strap. The other thing that you'll see is they're going to be made purely from textile and from fabric, so you will not see a lot of the neoprene finishes, et cetera, that you've seen over the past year.
Is the competition going to look less great for the next few years until the swimmers catch up with the new, less high-tech suits?
I'd be real surprised if that were the case. I would say there's no doubt world records will not be as easy to come by, but the athletes are going to step up. Will there be as many world records set the next 2 years as there was the past 2 years? Not even close. Right? But there will be world records set, and there'll be some great racing.
Mr. Wood, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jim Wood, who is president of USA Swimming. He spoke to us from New Jersey.
Let's hear more now about a deal that could change the way that people search the Internet. Microsoft announced today that it has reached a deal with Yahoo. It's a direct challenge to Google, the big search engine company, and these two companies plan to combine their search engine technology. We've called Todd Bishop, managing editor of TechFlash.com. He's covering the story from Seattle. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I am looking here at a Yahoo.com page. It's got the search line on the top where I could type in something and find out what's going on. How's it going to change, if in any way?
Well, to the average person, it won't change a whole lot. But essentially, behind the scenes, Microsoft's Bing technology will be powering that search experience if the companies are able to get regulatory approval for this deal.
Okay, so if it's going to look the same, but there's going to be some different software running in the background, what difference is it to the companies involved, Microsoft and Yahoo?
Well, Microsoft and Yahoo combined are in second and third place against Google. And if you take those two together, they'll have about 30% of the search market compared to Google's 65%. And they say that will give them the critical mass they need to give advertisers a real choice against Google.
Oh, so they're trying to get enough millions of eyeballs that they can sell a big package to advertisers of basically the Microsoft search engine and a Yahoo search engine at the same time?
That's precisely it. And there'll be a lot of behind-the-scenes relationships going on between the companies. They'll be having Yahoo, for example, sell search advertising, premium search advertising, sort of the relationship-based advertising sales, but Microsoft's technology will be essentially powering all of it underneath.
I just typed in on the Yahoo search engine, I typed in the word Microsoft, and I get some ads on the right-hand side based on my search here. You're saying that if I did that on the Microsoft engine or the Yahoo engine in the future, I might get the same ad and the same advertiser paid the same dollars to get in both places?
That's precisely right.
All right. Now, is that going to just mean a little bit more money for these two companies, or is it a bigger deal than that?
Well, long term, they're hoping that this will essentially change the landscape and give them a real leg up against Google, which has, you know, upwards of 70% of the market. And so they're hoping that this will give them the kind of momentum that will let them innovate and make the search experience better over the long term. The real question is whether or not this is going to be something that actually does change the game in that way, and whether regulators will approve it by next year.
Are Microsoft and Yahoo going to be able to work together, given that they've tried for years unsuccessfully to work together, and there was even an unsuccessful attempt to merge?
That's a great point. It was a year and a half ago that Microsoft actually tried to acquire Yahoo for many billions of dollars, and Yahoo rebuffed it. Since then, Yahoo has brought on a new CEO, Carol Bartz, from Autodesk, which has a relatively good relationship with Microsoft. It will be interesting to see how this plays out, but they certainly do have a better relationship at this point at the executive level than they have in the past.
Okay. Does Google seem scared at all?
You know, Google has not yet reacted this morning, but with, you know, upwards of 70% of the market, obviously they're in a very good position at this point. I think this is the type of thing that will play out over the next year, 2 years. And so in that way, it'll be something that could be a longer-term challenge to Google, but in the short term, probably won't have as much of an impact.
Well, I guess if you're the search engine that's on top, you have to be aware of the fact that everything can change on the Internet overnight, practically.
Absolutely, and obviously Google itself isn't standing still. It's trying to innovate in its core search experience, and it basically will have a slightly bigger competitor to compete with at this point.
Todd Bishop, managing editor of TechFlash.com, thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Steve.